This episode of Way of the Warrior is brought to you by Audible. If you want to pick up your very own free audiobook this weekend, you can do that. It's easy. Just go to audibletrial.com/Eric. It's audibletrial.com/Eric.
Yeah. Way of the Warrior, your MMA show.
10 seconds.
He rolls into it.
Wow, he might get it.
Way of the Warrior.
One of his legs could fight at welterweight, I'm sure.
Probably.
Roll mount, here's some ground and pound by Nogueira.
I think the first 2 minutes were everything we thought it was going to be, and then after that, it was the surprise of the night.
If it happens in MMA, you hear about it here. Your MMA show, Way of the Warrior.
All right, it is Way of the Warrior. We are in a post-UFC 200 haze. Ken, after Brock Lesnar left, Ken literally went to Disneyland, so he is not here. It is just you and just me covering the insanity that is mixed martial arts this week. And I don't even really know how one human being can wrap his head around what happened this week, but I'm going to do my best. And I'm also going to bring you a terrifically fun gift. That gift is Josh Gross joins us this week, and he's going to talk about his book, Ali vs. Inoki. And if you have not bought Ali vs. Inoki, and you'll hear me say this about 800 times to him, I fanboy a little bit, and I am unapologetic about my fanboyness, because if you have not read this book, and you are into pro wrestling, or into MMA, or into boxing, or like Ali, pick this thing up. Go to Amazon.com and do that. He will join us here in a little bit, but we will jump right into the insanity that is this week. And I think it's fair to start with Monday. And Monday, we all wake up after UFC 200. Three events in a row. Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night. The insane return of Brock Lesnar. And we're like, oh man, there's nothing else that could happen this year. The biggest card of the year, it maybe doesn't live up to the hype, but what else could, oh wait, they literally did just sell the UFC for $4.2 billion with a B. dollars. And I've done a couple interviews on radio this week about it, and there's been some misconception, which is interesting, that I think was quoted, don't quote me on this, but I think was quoted from Bloomberg, that it was 200 million to 4.2 billion. And that is, of course, not true. It's a purchase in 2000 of 2 million with an M dollars and a sell in 2016 for $4.2 billion. This is an absolutely insane business story. An absolutely insane business story. And I think as all of us sit around and we've been talking about the sale, what's going to happen with the sale? When is the sale going to happen? Is the sale going to happen? And then it happens. We're all left to sit around and go, okay, well, what's going to happen next? Will we even notice anything happening next? Will some of the things that we want to see happen, happen? Will fighter pay go up? Will fighter pay change at all? One of the things I was reading today, and we put it on our Facebook page, there was an interesting article, again, calling for a fighters union and showing how it works so well in the NBA. When the TV revenue goes up, the income for the players goes up, and that a model like that could work in the case of the UFC. And in that article, it quotes that less than 10% of the total income is what ends up going to the fighters. The rest of it goes to take care of whatever it needs to take care of. And you can start a list of amazing things that they've got to spend their money on and then look at the revenue that they walk away with. And then they make $4.2 billion. So they clearly, from a business standpoint, know what they're doing. And UFC 200 was a benchmark of knowing what they're doing. And we will get to that. But the sale itself is just crazy. And the people that are involved with the sale, it's, I mean, not too surprising that it ends up being the people that the MMA luminaries knew were going to be part of this thing, but still crazy that you wake up on Monday morning and it's a real thing. And man, I mean, good for those guys. I mean, the Fertittas and Dana White. And if you haven't heard, Dana White will stay on for 5 years, gets money on the out of UFC 1, gets money on the back end of UFC 2.0. So he will still be a part of this thing, and likely all these guys will be a part of it for a minute as they try and figure out how this business works and what they want to do with this business. But these guys that are involved in the purchase are not strangers to this business. So if you're thinking to yourself, oh, rich people bought it and then they're going to ruin it, these guys are – it's a who's who of investors and a who's who of investors who have connections with – sports management and they understand the sport, and they some of them helped get the UFC on TV. So there are some longstanding ties with this organization, and as far as we can tell, at least at this point, from a business perspective, they are in good hands. But a crazy, crazy thing to wake up to on Monday morning, that the UFC is finally sold. And as we speak right now, some of the people that we've been working with on this show have gotten new jobs already in the last 4 days. So it's exciting for them. So you're going to be seeing changes. And Josh Gross will talk a little bit about this in a little bit. But you'll see changes on the back end if you're on the inside. And on the outside, you likely won't see much for a long, long time. All right. The other big bit of news, and we will get to UFC 200 and the rest of the insanity that happened this past weekend in a second. But the other bit of big news that I want to talk about really quickly is Fabio Maldonado. If you were listening to the Joe Rogan podcast this week, Chael Sonnen was on, and they were talking about the Fedor Maldonado fight, and that Fedor clearly won that fight, and Maldonado levied two complaints that it was unfair and there was collusion and those sorts of things. And turns out he was right, because this afternoon the loss to Fedor was overturned and turned into a draw because of Fedor's connection with the people that put the event on. So that has been overturned, and he's yet another crazy story about what happens in and around Fedor's life with his connections. And say what you want about the stories being told about his connections, but clearly well connected. And this time they sort of got caught with their hand in the cookie jar, and that fight has been turned into a draw. Maldonado got part of what he wanted, not all of what he wanted. All right, let's get to what you guys want to talk about here. You want to talk about UFC 200. I know I've been watching you guys on Facebook talk about UFC 200. So let's get into this thing. And let me just say, top to bottom, was it the best card I've ever seen in my entire life? No. Was the pacing off? Yes. Were some of the things that happened, though, things that you want to talk about for a while? Yeah, I absolutely think so. I mean, we start on Thursday night with the incredible fight between RDA and Eddie Alvarez. And Eddie Alvarez, who's getting his lunch stolen from RDA in the beginning of that fight, absolutely being picked apart, and digs down, turns around, starches RDA, and takes the belt at lightweight. An incredible way to kick the weekend off. And now you're super excited about what's going to be happening. And then we get to the next night, and you get an even crazier fight. Claudia Gadelha winning those first two rounds. There's 10-8 rounds in those first two rounds. And Jędrzejczyk getting up in that third round and being like, yeah, I mean, that was, not fun, but I'm good now. It's now my turn to attack you, beat your ass. And that's exactly what she did. And she kept the belt, and she wants to defend one more time at that weight and then go up to 125, a division that doesn't actually exist yet, and essentially make that division. So essentially do what they did for Ronda Rousey. Now, is Johanna Jędrzejczyk the level of star that Ronda Rousey is? No, not at all. Could the UFC use a third women's division? I don't know. And that's it. To me, and if Ken were here, I bet we would get in a very interesting discussion about that. To me, that is not a comment on whether or not we would like to see more women's MMA, because I, for one, would, based on the main event that we saw at UFC 200, I don't know that I would be alone in that discussion. What I will say, though, is, as we all know, and the bantamweight belt, the 135 belt in the UFC will show you, it's still the wild, wild west out there. And if no one can hold that belt, and you've got a division in flux, and that's fun for viewership, that's not fun for legacy, and that's not fun for building a division if literally anyone can be champion. And that's not to undermine what's happening in the division, but the perception is you've got Holly Holm beats Ronda Rousey, Miesha Tate beats Holly Holm, Miesha Tate gets beat by Amanda Nunes, and now you wait and see, okay, well, will Amanda Nunes hang on to this, or will she get beat when Ronda Rousey comes back, or if she goes to fight Cyborg, or whatever will be next? That sort of flux is great for viewership, but it's not great for building a division. And if you have that much flux there, and then complete domination at 115 with Johanna Jędrzejczyk, and there's no one to challenge, because it's not like they're going to give Claudia Gadelha a trilogy, or at least they shouldn't, starting another division, I don't know that we're quite there yet. We'll get there for sure. I don't know if we're quite there yet. So will Johanna get her wish? Not sure. but we'll see. It was still an inspired performance, a fun fight to watch, and you're ready, at least you should be, ready to go for UFC 200. So we finally get there to UFC 200, and the undercard, my God, the undercard is this blistering collection of just insane fights, and I will not get into all of them. I will only say that, as I told you, the Joe Lozon, Diego Sanchez fight was super fun to watch. And I'm with Lozon. I don't necessarily want Diego to retire, but I do want him to retire soon if he's going to take that much damage. What I would like for him to do, though, is learn to move his head and not stand square to his opponent and stand on the logo and get ready to stand there and bang, because it's not good for his health and it's not a sound strategy, as you saw on Saturday night. That fight alone, I mean, you're ready to go. This was a fun collection of fights. And real quickly, we'll talk about our guest from last week, Sage Northcutt. Was that a great performance? No, but I think it soundly puts Sage Northcutt where Sage Northcutt needs to be. His jiu-jitsu is terrible, my friends. It's absolutely terrible. And he needs to work on that if he wants to go up in competition, because any one of those guys at 155 above where he is going to handle him fairly easily, at least if they get into any sort of jiu-jitsu grappling match, because he isn't there yet. He'll be there. This is not don't read this as a knock against Sage Northcutt, because it isn't. Is it a criticism? Yes, it's a criticism. But he's 20 years old. He's got plenty of time to become amazing. And he's got plenty of time to continue to take fights. And so there should be plenty of people in that ecosystem that you can have him fight before you move him up to heavy, 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 heavy competition. Because he's not ready for heavy, heavy, heavy competition. And smashing him does nothing for anyone. As I said when I talked to him, and I will say it again to you guys, his energy and his excitement about the sport is stuff that you need. You want a guy like that on TV, whatever that is. Prelims, I'm fine with that. I'm not arguing that he needs to be on the main card, but you want that guy on TV. You want that guy to humbly say that it's so fun to be in the UFC. I can't wait to fight again. I love this sport. You want that guy, because there's far too many people in the sport who are dour and try and out Robbie Lawler. When Robbie Lawler talks, it's terrifying. And he's brilliant at terrifying you, and he owns that. When Conor McGregor talks, it's slick, promo cutting, fun to watch conversation. Not everyone can do that. When Chael Sonnen talks, same thing. Not everyone can do that. And when you've got a guy who goes out there and acts like himself and is humble and says, I love this sport, I love it, I can't help but root for the guy. All that being said, it was not a spectacular performance on Saturday night. So he's got some learning to do. He's 20 years old. He's got some learning to do. That's an absolute fact. So let him do it. He doesn't need to go for the title next week. Clearly, he's not ready to go for the title next week. So let's stop talking like he's a contender or needs to be a contender. He's got plenty of time to become a contender. So give him some space and let him do that. Which brings us to the main card. We start with Cain Velasquez. Travis Brown. And that was the terrifying Cain of old. And I was talking to Sean Desay the other day about Cain Velasquez, and we were talking about how just fantastic that performance was and how we would love to see him continue those types of performances as he goes back up the ranks to clearly another title shot, because that guy is terrifying. And that guy against Stipe is a fun fight that I would like to see, but he needs to stay healthy and he needs to keep up that intensity. We've got a couple of guys in the organization that like to fight in that position and have a hard time fighting the other way around. I don't think it's fair to say, so I won't say that Cain loses his hunger when he has the belt. I really don't think that's fair at all. I just think you're seeing with all the stories coming out about Conor McGregor and the obligations that you have once you have the belt and what happened to Ronda Rousey and clearly what happened to Miesha Tate, that your world changes and not for the better when you have the belt, at least as far as competition goes. And so your ability to not have the pressure of the belt allows you to perform in a different way. And that Cain was absolutely, positively terrifying. absolutely terrifying. Cannot wait to see him fight again. It'll be fun to see what happens with Stipe in September. And if those two get another go at it before the end of the year, I would love to see Cain again before the end of the year if he can stay healthy. I think he needs that, and I think the sport needs that because you need those heavyweights in the division. Which brings us to Aldo and Frankie Edgar. And what can you say about that fight? Well, here's what you can say about that fight. At no point, and I mean at no point, did Frankie Edgar have a shot in that fight once it started. Aldo looked spectacular against Frankie Edgar. That said, I don't think the crowd got particularly into it because I just don't think... And this is where the pacing falls off, right? Because the undercard was so fast and lots of fun knockouts. And I'm not one that needs to always see a knockout, but the pacing in the main card just didn't work out very well because you had this fight and then you had the Daniel Cormier-Anderson Silva thing, which we'll talk about. And then you had Brock and Mark Hunt. And then, of course, you had the main event. So the pacing falls apart here. And as fun for me as it was to see Aldo do his thing for as long as he felt like doing his thing, a five-round fight in the second fight in the card, not really a wise idea for an interim championship. And I don't think that Aldo beats Edgar. Sorry, I don't think that Aldo. And I don't think that Aldo beats Conor McGregor either. The Diz, friend of the show, he and I were talking on Twitter today. He thinks it's a minute before Aldo gets knocked out again. I'm going to give it 90 seconds. I still think that Conor knows exactly where to hit on Aldo to end this thing. And I just don't see Aldo doing any of what he was able to do against Edgar against Conor McGregor. And that's really what I took away from that fight. It was fun to see. It was a great spotlight of Aldo clearly back where he needs to be and understanding how he needs to own the octagon and control the action and the distance and the pace and all of that stuff. The ring generalship was on point. Is he going to beat Conor McGregor? I just don't think so. At least not that one. I mean, who knows? Maybe he's got another gear or two he can bring up, but it's not as if you should slack on Frankie Edgar because he's a guy who can always be in that fight, but he was not even on the same level on Saturday night against Jose Aldo. Which brings us to Daniel Cormier and your boy, the Spider, Anderson Silva. Can we please, please, please stop talking about how bad this fight was? Because one, it wasn't bad. Was it exciting? No, it wasn't a bad fight. It just wasn't exciting. And Daniel Cormier had everything, and I mean everything, to lose in that fight. And for me, I just wish, and I said this on Sunday morning, I wish Daniel didn't need to take that fight to get paid. I wish he wasn't making so much money that he needed to do that in order for them to pay him part of what he was going to get. They're rumored, both guys rumored to get 8 or 9 figures if John Jones had made that fight. So I get it. He's taking the fight because he needs the payday. He's taking the fight because, you know, he needs to get paid and he's done all the training and he's already there and he's got an opponent and it's Anderson Silva. But it was a lose fight for Daniel Cormier. Lose fight. And on a different level than a lose fight where Tony Ferguson goes against Lando, a guy that had never fought in the UFC. That's a lose as well on a different level. This is lose on a grand scale. If you get starched by Anderson Silva on 3 days' notice, now, it's Anderson Silva, but it's post-prime Anderson Silva, so you can't really do that and continue to go. That said, the common thought right now is that Daniel still essentially lost that fight because he needed to make a statement. He needed to do something when it went to the ground, and he didn't do that stuff. And so he still ends up living in this middle ground that he hates. He wants everyone to love him. Most people boo him. And he wants to get out of that middle ground. Well, the problem with being in the middle ground or being the nice guy is that the nice guy isn't really interesting. They're still going to pop for John Jones when he comes back in 2 years, if that's indeed what the suspension is. If it's estrogen blockers that he's truly been tested for, and I have not been able to confirm or deny that since Chael said that on the two podcasts on Monday. But if that's indeed what he got popped for, and he gets suspended for 2 years, when he comes back, believe it, he's going to get a pop, a giant pop against whoever he goes against, because the fans, they forget, and the fans like a comeback story, and Daniel Cormier hasn't been able to do that. Daniel Cormier hasn't gotten a fair shake, and Daniel Cormier to me, is a Hall of Famer in this sport that really never got the fair shake from the fans that he should have gotten. And so the fight was terrible in that regard, in the fact that he lost even when he won, but it wasn't a terrible contest. He did what he needed to do to get out of that with a win. When you put that formula, though, on paper, of course the fight's going to be terrible. If I told you I'm going to show up to work, I'm just going to do the bare minimum of what I have to do in order to get paid, do you think that I would get a bonus? Do you think I would get a promotion? Do you think people at my workplace would love working with me, the guy that does the least possible to get by? No. So when you take that formula and you put it into combat sports and you go, all right, I'm going to do whatever I need to do to win this fight, but no more and no less, it's a recipe for disaster, and that's exactly what you got. Because if you look at the two fights back-to-back, pacing by putting Brock Lesnar and Daniel Cormier back-to-back is dumb. And you saw that in hindsight. But if you watch the two fights, they're identical. And people cheered for Brock Lesnar and jeered Daniel Cormier. Which moves us to Brock Lesnar and Mark Hunt. Another fight where I've had some conversations with people this week that have left me scratching my head. And I scratched my head by saying, look, is Brock Lesnar an elite MMA striker? Hell no. Is Brock Lesnar an elite MMA fighter? Well, I think you could discuss that because he just beat a guy who fought for the title this year. He just beat a guy who fought for the title this year. And he did it by severely upping his fight IQ, knowing that Mark Hunt had one weapon and took away that weapon. Does Brock like to get punched in the face still? Hell no, he doesn't. He's not like to get touched at all. I mean, at all, which is not a good look for the sport. You got to take some damage. We'll talk about Ferguson in a minute, but not Tony Ferguson damage, but you have to take some damage in these fights because you can't just be ducking out of the way. And I don't mean in a skill level. I mean, in like, I'm an afraid to get punched sort of way. You can't do that and be successful. Brock on Saturday night was successful, which I found astonishing. Not because I didn't think he could win it, but listen to this sentence. A guy who fought in the UFC 5 years ago and since then has been a pro wrestler, jumped off the bench, came to the UFC, fought the number 5 or 6 guy in the heavyweight division who just fought for the title in this calendar year and beat him in 3 rounds. Let me say that one more time. A guy who fought in the UFC at a high level but 5 years ago, was doing professional wrestling, came back off the bench, fought in their biggest card of the year, essentially saving the pay-per-view, right? Essentially saving the pay-per-view dollars, fought against the 5 or 6 guy in the heavyweight division, beat him. And that number 5 or 6 guy in Mark Hunt fought for the title in the last calendar year. Sorry, guys, that's an amazing story. I don't care what you say. Is it Bisping amazing? No, it isn't Bisping amazing, but it's still an amazing story. And you have to give it to Brock Lesnar. And I loved the Brock Lesnar all week, and I loved the Brock Lesnar in the post-fight interview. He didn't shut the door on coming back, and he was super humble, being like, hey, I've still got some stuff to do, some work to do, and I'd love to maybe come back and do this 1 or 2 more times, but like, let's not celebrate that this was some spectacular performance by me. I got through this, and I'm happy for the win, but I got some work to do. I love that. I love his humility. I think it's great. It's a great look on him. I thought it was a great look for him. And then we get to the main event. Miesha Tate and Amanda Nunes. And as that fight is starting, I'm texting anyone I know who I know is watching this fight saying, wow, Miesha Tate looks like she's terrified before this fight starts. And turns out Miesha Tate was terrified for this fight because she got absolutely demolished. Now, the knee that sort of started all this off lands on the shoulder of Miesha Tate or glances off the shoulder of Miesha Tate. It's really not worth discussing, but it is worth noting that that could have spelled disaster for Amanda Nunes. And if I was her camp, I would go back and make sure that we're upping the fight IQ to know that that's not a place where we're going to strike people, because that could have been all she wrote. And a DQ would have been catastrophic. Now, it didn't happen, so we'll move on from there. Amanda Nunes just destroyed Miesha Tate, which leaves this entire division up for debate. but also puts this entire division in the same discussion that Daniel Cormier is in. Yeah, I mean, you know, Amanda Nunes has the belt, but Amanda Nunes beat a girl who got beat by Ronda Rousey, right? Misha Tate, her best known thing is getting beat by Ronda Rousey. And she won the belt after getting beat by Holly Holm until she Anderson Silva'd Holly Holm. She wins by rear naked choke. And seemingly the last possible second, she was not winning that fight at that point, but she finished it and won that fight. Holly Holm was going to win that decision. Misha Tate stole the belt, went to go defend the belt, and it got stolen by Amanda Nunes. The first openly gay UFC fighter wins the belt on Saturday night. A spectacular way, in my opinion, a spectacular way to finish this night of fights. You can talk about the pacing and how it wasn't awesome. You can talk about how some of the fights weren't what you wanted them to be, the Daniel Cormier fight being one of them, the Brock Lesnar fight. I guess if you thought that Brock and Mark Hunt were going to stand in the middle and bang, you've never watched a Brock Lesnar fight, so I don't know what you were expecting, but I can understand that you're not super fired up about it. Which brings us to our guest. I've been waiting to do this for about 2 weeks. I reached out to Josh Gross as soon as the book dropped, Ali vs. Inoki. It came out on June 21st, the week after, I think 2 or 3 days after Ali passed. And as soon as I got it, I just tore into it and started reading. And if you don't know about this fight, it's essentially the biggest wrestler versus boxer fight of all time that essentially started what we know as mixed martial arts. Now, I'm not going to spoil the book for you, and I don't mean like spoil the fight because you can watch the fight on YouTube, but there's lots of cool stuff in the book. And Josh just writes a fantastic, fantastic narrative around this fight. So I was excited to get him on, and we were able to do that. He joins us now. Josh Gross is on the line. The book is Ali versus Inoki. Josh, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Of course, yeah, man. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. As I said on Twitter, I cannot say enough brilliant things about this book. In fact, the only complaint I would have is, like, why didn't you do one earlier?
Well, that's great to hear. Thank you, really. I mean, I appreciate that.
Like, you know, I've been covering the sport for probably 6 or 7 years, not to the extent, clearly, that you and others who do this as a full-time venture, but I read a lot of this stuff, and I just think it's profound the way that you laid out this story. And as much as I do want to talk a little bit about the premise of the story for people who don't know it and why it's important, I wanted to spend a minute or two kind of talking about what was the process and how in the world did you get this story essentially into this funnel? Because as you're reading this, it just, I know the quote on the back is about when is the movie coming out, but as you're reading this, it really does feel like it should be a movie, and there's all of these moving parts and how they all come together. So what was, first of all, when did you decide to start writing this, and how did you kind of start to put the process together to make it into one book as opposed to, like, I don't know, the Lord of the Rings of boxing and mixed martial arts and pro wrestling?
Yeah, well, I think the match itself is not a Rocky story, right? I mean, this is not a... you're not writing a book about this amazing contest, so you have to make a way to find its relevance and, you know, where it is interesting. And, you know, I knew that I wouldn't be spending most of the time on this epic contest. I had to write around the match and the people involved. And there were so many amazing characters and so many different sort of elements to the story. As I discovered it, I realized, you know, I had to weave a lot in there. Plus, I got to say, this is my first book, and I don't know what it's like to write a book without the internet, but with the internet, I mean, you could sort of jump into something and it would take you 100 different places. And I really felt like it was much more textured because I could dive into some rabbit holes, and it took me some places I really didn't know or expect. And I learned a lot, you know, through that process. So I think a lot of those reasons in particular.
And Josh, I know you've said in other interviews that this book, on top of being, you know, the fight is the backdrop, because like you said, it's not a Rocky story. It tells the story of two different Alis, the fall of Ali, so to speak, and the early stages. But some of the more, for me, some of the more profound parts of the book are, as you're reading this in 2016, the things in this book that you just couldn't imagine, the ESPYs were last night, the things in this book you just could not imagine happening in 2016 without profound consequences. And by that, I mean, like, you write about when Ali comes out with Malcolm X and converts to Islam. Like, as I'm reading that, and I, of course, knew that that happened and knew when it happened and all of that stuff. But when you read it in 2016, you think to yourself, what would that be like if that happened yesterday?
Oh, I mean, social media and the way that information is disseminated has changed a tremendous amount. Yeah, I don't know. I think the way we see some celebrity reactions on social media, how things can blow up, you know, in pretty bold ways. And you don't see a lot of athletes, although now you're seeing in the discussion more with Black Lives Matter and a lot of discussion around the ESPYs itself. You mentioned, I think, LeBron James. You know, people are sort of talking about those connections now. It's interesting in the you know, early wake of Ali's passing that, you know, these social justice issues are still at the forefront of sport. They always have been. But I think celebrity and the way that social media has changed how we view that and what that actually means, you know, I'm sure there would be a much quicker, shriller price to pay for those sorts of actions. You know, there was obviously there's a lot of negative feedback about Ali and he felt it in many different ways, but sort of the immediacy of it, the weight of, you know, a billion people jumping on you with opinions is quite a thing. So I don't know. He, you know, he lived a great life. He lived an amazing life. And many of the things he did would have garnered a reaction from large segments of the population. And I don't know that people can do that today in this environment. It's a shame if not, but, you know, he was a man of convictions 100% and he didn't care what was in front of him. So he was an amazing person.
Josh Gross is joining us. The book is Ali versus Inoki. And as I said, if you're into boxing, if you're into pro wrestling, if you're into MMA, and obviously if you're listening to the show, you're into all three of those things. This is an absolute must read. Josh, one of the things that I also took away and enjoyed about the book and was getting into in one of the earlier questions was when you're reading through this book, the amount of people that still have touch points into mixed martial arts, it's such an interesting microcosm of history. Like, it feels like, and I don't know if you felt this while you were writing the book, but it feels like there could be five or six books about the characters that you write about just in this moment as we go from this fight into modern mixed martial arts, into UFC 200 era, into whatever the future is going to be. Did you feel that, as there are still people that are relevant in the sport today that had something to do with this fight?
Oh, no question. I mean, so many of the characters and people in my book have books written about them multiple times over. So, you know, it was a real collection of famous, important, interesting people coming together for this event. And, you know, I don't think there's any doubt of that. You know, as far as, you know, people still being around today and having touched this, I mean, Jean LaBelle is probably number one on the list.
Sure.
And he was very important for the telling of my story. I probably spoke to him more than anyone else. Lots of time spent in his office, in his home in the Valley and here in Southern California. And I've known Gene for a long time, having been around Southern California martial arts, mixed martial arts, I mean, in particular. And just, you know, his reputation, everybody knows Gene LaBelle, you know, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And, you know, his story, it's great that his story and other people's stories are, you know, have been able to come out more recently as people start looking back on MMA history, but also, you know, just my chance to do that in this book. You know, there's a lot of people like Gene that I didn't realize how important their legacies were and who they touched and where they went and, you know, how deeply it all worked together. But it was fun to learn about, and that they have great stories, and I hope their stories come out even more.
And Josh, when you were collecting these stories, what was the reaction to them when you told them what you were doing and what you were writing? Were people thinking, finally, somebody's going to tell this story? Or were they feeling like you were like, well, this isn't really a Rocky story. What are you going to do with this event?
You know, it was all over the map. I definitely got a lot of people saying, well, why would you write about this? this is stupid. And those people were more the, you know, the boxing crowd, the people who were around Ali for a long part of his life. You know, they didn't understand, because this, in a lot of ways, the match has always been framed as a low moment in Ali's career and as a dud and a farce and kind of a joke. And, you know, I can't believe he did it. That's how the boxing crust treated at the time. And that's, you know, really the reputation of it, even up to today. And I hope when people read the book that, you know, perhaps they view it differently, that they see a different legacy for the match, that Ali showed a ton of guts for getting in there and fighting. And Antonio Inoki is incredibly important to how mixed martial arts works today. So yeah, there's a lot in there. There's no question about it. And it was fun to piece together.
Josh Gross joining us, the book Ali vs. Inoki. You can get it right now. Pretty much anywhere. Clearly you could start at Amazon or you could start at Gross Point Blank, which is your website, and go from there. As the book,
actually, don't go to my website. Okay. I haven't done anything on my website in like a year, so like okay. leave my website alone. It's actually kind of embarrassing. But please go to Amazon instead. Yeah.
Okay, go to Amazon and get it from Amazon. So you know, as the book is winding towards the match itself, and the rules are being decided on or not being decided on. Is this going to be a work? Is this going to be a shoot? It eventually ends up being a shoot. What do you think? If anything, could have made this thing be successful? Like, would it have been better if it had been a work? Would that have been easier to understand for people to grasp the concept? Because for people who have not watched the fight, it's available on YouTube, but essentially it's Inoki kicking the legs of Ali for 15 rounds and Ali not really sure how to handle that. What if anything, do you think could have changed to change what happened to that sport or that fight, I should say?
Well, I think the number one reason that it looked the way it did was the rules. And the rules are something I spent a lot of time on in the book, in different sections of the book, because they're important to understanding, you know, the concept that was going down. Boxer versus wrestler is something that's been going on for a long time. There's a long time, you know, how do you make that happen? What does that fight look like? There was no mixed martial arts. There was no unified rules to govern these kinds of fights. Styles were coming together, and you had to negotiate what that fight looked like. So Ali's people, this is Ali in 1976 after the thrill in Manila. He's about, well, his contract says he should make $6.1 million for this fight. And his people know that he's got a fight coming up in September against Ken Norton at Yankee Stadium. So they're trying to protect him as much as they could. And the rule negotiations, you know, went up into fight week. There was a lot of concern that when there was talk about doing a pro wrestling match, that, you know, Inoki, maybe he pulls a double cross here. And, you know, Ali's expecting a fun pro wrestling match and Inoki, like, breaks his arm. So they felt like they had to protect themselves. And that was a big piece of it. And so Inoki was restricted. The Wednesday night before the fight, they had a dinner, like some big expensive, like $150 plate dinner. At the fighter hotel in Tokyo, and Inoki complains about the rules. He said, I can't do this, I can't do that, but I'm going to sign this agreement anyway. So I think that really dictated most of it.
And you know, if the rules had been decided on in a way that allowed Inoki to do what he wanted to do, and this fight turned out differently, do you think, given your expertise in mixed martial arts, do you think that that would have sped up what we know as MMA, or do you still think it would have been at least another decade for that to kind of develop into a sport that had legs to become what it is today?
I don't know. I don't know how people would have reacted if Muhammad Ali had been taken down and submitted or choked or something. I don't know. That would have been really interesting. Sort of to play that out, that exercise. But I would imagine it would have been huge news, and it would have made people want to see Ali in a rematch or some sort of scenario where now, you know, you were talking about those kinds of matchups more. But this one definitely didn't help it right then. But I don't think there's any doubt that in the long run, this match happening and the way it happened and the people involved led to a lot of the things that make up what we know today is modern mixed martial arts. The business model of MMA is basically a hybrid of like pro wrestling and sport, and the structure, the organization structure is much more pro wrestling like. And that comes from these kinds of contests because that's how it was basically structured from, you know, when this thing became big business in the late 90s, mid late 90s and early, you know, that period. So I think you look at pro wrestling and boxing coming together, and there's a lot of ties that make it a unique story. Not just the match itself, but the businesses, what it meant for the businesses. And I get into a lot of that.
The book is Ali vs. Inoki. You can get it on Amazon right now. Josh Gross is joining us. So Josh, I know you're in promotion period for this, and you said this was your first book. My assumption is, and I'm not asking you on the hook or anything like that, but my assumption is there are other books that you're going to write. Is that a true assumption?
I'd certainly like to. I have a couple of ideas that I would like to move forward on right now, and we'll see. But I got to tell you, I loved writing the book. The whole process of doing it was great. But, you know, the book business is crazy. It's like, I bet people probably think, oh my, you write a book and it's $1 billion. It's a grind for sure. The people are not buying books these days. So I appreciate you having me on here to talk about the book, and hopefully a few people hear about it and they want to pick it up. I really appreciate that.
Well, Josh, I mean, you know, I reached out to you, and I think we talked probably a number of years ago about, I'm sure, about something, but like I reached out to you again because as soon as I saw this book was out, I pre-ordered it, and I was 100 pages in when I reached out to you, and I was like, more people need to know about this book, because not only if you care about Ali, if you want to know about this piece of history that most people don't know about or may never even have known happened, if you like MMA, if you want to kind of know where that might have come from or some of the crazy stuff that happened in the world of pro wrestling back then, this is a must read. But more importantly, and I know this doesn't really fit on an MMA podcast, but I don't care, it's mine. More importantly, I think the way that you structured this book and the way that you write and the way that you tell these stories, and even the simple stories are the ones that, like last night, I was going through some of my notes. There's the story where Ali gets a hold of a transistor radio and is recording it to his,
right,
you know,
right.
Like, even those stories, I'm like, this is so good. And I, you know, I hope you get to write as many books as you want to. And I understand the book business isn't what it is, but dude, yeah. Like, this thing is such a gift to people if they just sit down and pick it up and read it. It is so good, and I cannot say enough good things about it. And I want everyone to go to Amazon like right now and buy it, because it's just like, I'm telling you, the way that you write this story is just killer.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. That's amazing to hear, and I really appreciate it. Thank you, and I'm glad you're enjoying it, man. Quite honestly, it's fun to hear people speak like that. I feel good about the book that I wrote, and you're very kind. Thank you.
Well, you know, and that's a skill that not a lot of people have. I mean, we're in an era, let's be honest, where, you know, if somebody wanted to write a book, they can write a book. You have a book deal, but that's not necessary. And I think this is the difference, is that when a professional writes a book, you can tell. And in those little moments, like the transistor radio moment, really has nothing to do with the fight itself, but was something that I went, that's like this beautiful simplicity in this book that's repeated over and over and over again, and why people should pick this up and read this from cover to cover. And so I just wanted to say that to you and get the hyperbole out of the way, because I really brought you on because I wanted to ask you a real question, is that I'm assuming you sent champagne to Dana White, right?
No, I didn't. I didn't even text him this time. No. He was going to buy Strikeforce, I was trying to break the story then and work on that story. I didn't do too much reporting on the story, and I wasn't bugging too many people.
Yeah.
I had heard a lot, and I knew the sale was going down, and it's obviously a wild moment. But sure, congratulations to Dana White, quite honestly. In 2007, when Brock Lesnar had his match at the LA Coliseum, his debut, Dana was going crazy in all the media because we were covering it, and he was sending us crazy texts and stuff like that. And he told me that night that even if this is 2007, he goes, "I've always been crazy. Now I'm crazy and fucking rich." So that's what he tells me, like, in 2007. Now it's 2016, and he, like, has more control of the UFC, and he's worth $360 million. It's a real test of where Dana White's at and what kind of leader he'll be for the UFC. So I'm interested to see these 5 years for him. You can't question the results, even if the methods sometimes aren't the best. But congratulations to him and Lorenzo Fertitta. $2 million to $4 billion is not so bad.
No, it's an incredible business story. And one last question before I let you go. You know, any sense of when fans might see, and you might not even have an answer to this, but you, like I said, it's rare that we get an opportunity to talk to you, so I would feel remiss if I didn't ask you this. Any sense of when the fans might see any sort of changes in the organization within the sale, or is that something that they might not see for another decade?
No, I think on the day-to-day fight business, what people see on television, it's not going to look any different. I think it'll be very consistent. I think the fights will be very consistent. They'll still continue to be the UFC in terms of all that. Behind the scenes, I think you'll probably see some shifts and change. Executive people will be in and out of Zuffa, obviously a much less control over the UFC. So I think you'll see a lot of those people go back to the casino business with Lorenzo Fertitta. But I think they created a sustainable, big business. There's a few people in that business who, if they want to stick around, I think would be really good CEOs. And you'll probably hear Gary Cook's name a lot. He's a possibility. There's also the CFO in that company is thought of really highly, and he may take that job. So it'll be interesting to see behind the scenes. But I do think mixed martial arts will continue to expand and grow. The UFC signed made a massive deal, and then a day later, I mean, you know, ONE FC got announced as taking, I think it was $1 billion or something like that from this major fund. I mean, this fund is worth $256 billion. So the money that we're talking about now for mixed martial arts is really wild. And I think it's, you know, shoot, as a media guy, you know, you sort of, you know, hope some of that money comes your way in different, you know, you'd like just that the work is there.
Right.
Because the sport seems to be thriving from a monetary sense. And hopefully a lot of that money goes to the fighters and just continues to drive this thing globally, because I think that's where it's going to go. You're going to see this more in Asia and China. And I think, you know, mixed martial arts will become, I've always considered it a global niche. Interesting to see now during this period if it can grow beyond that niche status. But it already attracts an extremely wide segment of the human population who are interested and want to watch. And I expect more of that.
Josh Gross has joined us. The book is Ali vs. Inoki. You can get it on Amazon right this very second. Josh, have a wonderful day. Thank you so much for spending a couple minutes with us. And thank you again for writing the book.
Sure, man. Awesome to be on. And thank you again for your words, man. Really appreciate that. Thanks.
All right, and there he goes. As you probably know, or if you don't, you can get him on Twitter, at Yayi, Y-A-Y underscore Y-E-E. We'll put it in the show notes. And you can buy the book on Amazon, as I've said, Ali vs. Inoki. Go get that. And, of course, we had one more, because why wouldn't we need one more set of fights in the last 7 days? On Wednesday night, we had UFC Fight Night 91, which will come as no surprise as the lowest-ranked fight night in a long, 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 maybe even ever, long, 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 long time. People were done. If you are going to play Trivial Pursuit tonight, and the question is, how many UFC fights can you have in 1 week? The answer is not four. The answer is clearly three, because nobody wanted to watch this fight. And I mean, no one wanted to watch this fight. Which is a shame, because there were two really, I mean, there were some fun fights on this card if you were still up for fight action. But if you're invested in the sport, there were two really interesting fights. John Lineker and Michael McDonald, as Michael McDonald gets destroyed by Lineker. And I've said this for a long time on this podcast. I like, and I mean love, John Lineker. I love what the guy does. He has ridiculously heavy hands. And it was very, very hard for him to make weight to fight DJ at 125. So at 135, it's a little bit easier for him, and he's still destroying people. So him wanting to fight Cruz and DJ, I love the idea of that. I absolutely love the idea of it. I love these guys that want to move between weight classes. He just hasn't been very successful at it. So I don't know if I'm the UFC. I trust him to make weight for a title shot against DJ when he couldn't do it when they asked him to the first time. So I don't know if I trust that guy to do that. Dominic Cruz, though, we can do that fight. Let's do that fight. But DJ, I'm not so sure about that. If you can, I would love it. But I would hold him in the same weight regard as I would Cyborg. You want to fight Ronda Rousey? Got to make the weight. You want to fight Amanda Nunes? Got to make the weight. You want to fight DJ? You got to make the weight, and you got to do it easy. You got to get somebody in your camp that can help you make that weight. And the other fight, Lando and Ferguson. Holy cow, man. For me, that fight is why we love watching the sport, right? Lando's never fought in the UFC. It's his UFC debut. He fights at a totally different weight class. He's a featherweight, but he comes up to take this fight, and he just wants to throw down with Tony Ferguson, who is willing to oblige until he wasn't. And then he's like, okay, I'm good with this. Taking shots I don't need. Now it's time to sub you. And man, Ferguson is just having an amazing 2 years. And I would love to see him. I'm still pining for the Nurmagomedov fight, but I mean, I hope the timing works out for that, whenever that works out. But if you want to give him Alvarez, I'm down. Let's do that. Let's totally do that. Alvarez and Ferguson, I'm totally down with doing that. And the way that Kevin Lee looked this week, man, if he's going to keep that up, if we could ever get a Michigan versus Michigan, we can get a Ferguson and Kevin Lee fight going, I'm down with that one too. As always, if you need anything, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook by searching WOW Show. And I want to wish a very happy birthday weekend to our executive producer, Ryan Dempsey, who is out celebrating by eating some sort of cake, I'm assuming, that he made for himself by himself. All right. Have a great weekend. It is Way of the Warrior. It's your MMA show.